is a Jerry Pippin special report. Consciousness and the UFO.
Hello, everyone. This is Jerry Pippin. We're going to talk to Dr. Bruce Maccabee first, then bring in Grant Cameron, and maybe Grant and Bruce both can join in the conversation. But first, before we bring on Grant, who, by the way, is going to be lecturing on this topic in Philadelphia this weekend, and that's one reason we even planned the show. And then Dr. Bruce Maccabee became available, and I thought, you know, we never get a chance to talk to him enough. And by the way, Bruce, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Nice to be here.
And, you know, we urge people to stick around, excuse me, for the end of the show. When your part's over, we're going to close out with you playing the piano. Do you still have that CD for sale?
Yes, I do. And the last piece on the CD called New Age Rising was composed to be played at the 1997 MUFON Symposium, 40 years, 40th anniversary. And it was, I guess, in some way inspired by UFOs.
Yeah, we're going to play one of those selections here in a little bit. You really enjoy playing music, don't you? Because I've talked to people at your house a couple of times, and they say, well, Bruce is down at the church playing music.
Yeah, that's right. I've played for churches as well as dances and concerts and stuff. Unfortunately, my right hand has taken a loss in capability over the last some number of months. So I'm not up to speed like I used to be, but I can still do some. I can still bend a good key here and there.
Now, when we talk to you, we usually talk about photographic evidence and things like that, and we'll probably talk about that tonight as well. But what's happening with Bruce Maccabee of late? You got any interesting things to tell us?
Well, Jan and I got married back in February, and we've got a new horse. Whether the Facebook page of me or Jan Maccabee, you'll find stuff that's up to date as to what's happening. Aside from that, my son is in a band called The Tenth Hour, which is taking a national tour at the present time. It's a metal band, and they've been hitting some 50 places in 60 days, I think it is, in September and October. And there's projectindependent.net. If you look at that, you can see where this band is going to be, on what day and what location, if anybody's interested in going and listening.
Bruce, I'm going to bring in Grant Cameron to say hello to you. You guys know each other, right? I mean, he's talked to you before.
Yes.
Yeah, I've known Bruce fairly well because he helped me out. He was involved in the Rockefeller Initiative stuff, so he was kind enough to provide me the briefing that he had prepared for President Clinton's science advisor and helped me out quite a bit in putting that story together. So, yeah, we go back quite a while.
Bruce, a lot of people call on you, and you keep busy just helping people with their stories.
Well, that's true. I get one or two photo cases, sometimes more than that, per week, most of which turn out to be, you might say, accidents of photography as opposed to something that's provably a UFO. One case I recently investigated involved a image of a vertical line of exposed film, or actually it wasn't film, it was a digital camera, but silhouetted against the blackness of the sky. Somebody was trying to take pictures of meteors and simply taking pictures hoping a meteor would fly through it. And he got this vertical line in which colors change, a lot of line colors change from red to green to yellow to orange and so on. He wondered what in the world it was. He didn't think it was a meteor, so I analyzed it and decided that he had moved the camera a little bit. He was apparently looking at a very bright light, maybe Venus or a star or planet. and the color change was a result of twinkling due to the atmosphere. I've got on my website pictures out of a video showing what happens when you take a picture of a bright light in the at night, when it's, especially when it's low on the horizon. You get a lot of color changing, and people don't understand that. But that's the type of thing that I get, daytime photos of accidents, you might say. But occasionally, not too far from where I live, there was a very interesting video of a light taken last April. And it seems to me that something happened to the cell phone the guy was using to videotape it. At any rate, I haven't come to any conclusions as to what that could have been yet. So sometimes you run into things that are seem to be unexplainable. You can go to my webpage and you'll see a whole bunch of stuff that's unexplainable.
You mentioned your webpage. Go ahead and give it for everyone. And Grant, give your webpage after he finishes, because both of you guys have some very, very interesting things on there. Well, Bruce, give your webpage right now.
www.brumac.8k.com. That's B-R-U-M-A-C dot number 8, letter K, dot com. Brumac.8k.com. And there's 100 megabytes of worthy information on there.
And Grant Cameron, we're going to talk to you about your lecture coming up in Philadelphia later in the program, but go ahead and give your website now.
My website is the President's UFO website, which is at presidentialufo.com.
And we've got a lot of things we're going to get into here in a little bit. One thing before we even get into any of this, Grant, I want to ask Bruce one thing that I've been meaning to ask him several times. And that's the evolution of technology. You've been doing photographic analysis for a long time, Bruce. And has the technology improved at all, or is it kind of messed up? Give us an overview of how this works.
Well, of course, you have to know how the ancient technology, which we still have with us, that is, taking pictures that create film, and how that differs from modern technology, which uses so-called charge-coupled devices and similar things to record a picture. Old technology and new technology both use optics, lenses, and a camera, whether the camera is a teeny-weeny thing inside your cell phone or a big camera with a big telephoto lens on it, for example. You have to have a lens system that focuses the scene onto a surface. Typically, the surface is flat. So you have a lens that focuses the scene onto the surface, and this is the first half, you might say, of a photographic system, is the focusing part. In the old technology and the new technology, the focusing part is the same. The recording part, which you look at afterwards and see the picture, that's what has changed. In the old days, it was a film. Of course, you can still get film. And that was a light coming in through the optical system gets focused onto the film surface and actually affects the chemistry of the surface a little bit. And then you run the film through various chemicals known as developers and fixers and stuff, and you end up with a picture. Could be black and white, could be colored depending on the nature of the surface that you're focusing onto, the type of film. More modern cameras use charge-coupled devices that are made up of an array, an XY, or a vertical horizontal array of things which we call picture elements, pixels, P-I-X-E-L. Each pixel is a little light detector, a little thing that responds, it puts an output voltage that's proportional to how much light it's collected over a period of time. So you have a shutter in both the old technology and the new technology. A shutter is something which opens the optical system for a period of time and then closes it after a period of time. This could be a few seconds, it could be a very small fraction of a second that the shutter is open. And once these, once the shutter is open, light is, either hits film or it hits these pixels of a CCD detector and is recorded, and then the shutter closes. Because the shutter is not open for, because the shutter is open for a short period of time, if you have an object that's moving or if the camera is vibrating, you can get a blurred image. That happens both with old technology and new technology. And the new technology with the pixels and so on is very amenable to manipulation by computer techniques. You take a picture and you can brighten it, you can darken it, you can stretch it, you can warp it, you can add things in, take things out, all with the aid of a computer system. People know about various computer programs for modifying pictures, whether the pictures are taken by a camera or scanning a film-type picture to put it into a computer.
Yeah, Grant, as we could tell by what Bruce was saying, it's no wonder he's recognized as an expert. I know you've gone to him, and a lot of people have. And we're going to get into some of the things you're doing, Greg Cameron, here in a minute. But one of those things, is it okay if I bring up Chase Brandon to you, Grant? I mean, we talked about it for a long time. But what's the latest on this guy?
Well, he did about 6 or 7 interviews, and then he just disappeared. I think it's probably one of the most significant stories to happen in the last couple of years, because even though I got a question through to some of the interviewers who were interviewing him, he stated that at no time did the CIA ever talk to him about this story that he put out, that he had seen this box with Roswell material that confirmed that Roswell had existed at Langley headquarters. He said the CIA never talked to him about it. He didn't talk to the CIA about the fact he was going to say this. And I just don't think that's plausible. So I think
Dr. McAbee's been involved with the government. He worked for the Navy, the department, right, at one time? Do you know Chase Brandon?
No.
You know anything about him?
No, nothing about him except I read some message saying his first name was Charles.
Yeah.
And Chase.
Yeah, right. Does that sound plausible to you that the CIA didn't talk to him?
Well, I don't know. The CIA's done some funny stuff, shall we say, over the years. And has taken what I'd call a muddled approach to this problem. I'm sure that most people at the CIA don't know anything about this subject. When I spoke to the CIA as a lecturer in the summer, July of 1987, I gave a lecture at the CIA building in what I was told was the director's conference room. There were about 50 people who attended at a lunchtime briefing. This was unclassified. I told them about their own documents. CIA documents had been released in December of 1978. 900 and some pages that the CIA initially had said didn't exist. And then a judge, under a lawsuit that was filed against the CIA, a judge directed the CIA to search their files, find out if they had anything on UFOs, and sure enough, they had 900 pages worth of stuff on UFOs. And that was released in December of 1978.
Okay.
CIA stuff was released in December of 1978. So in 1987, when I spoke, to my great surprise, hardly anybody there knew that there was UFO stuff in the CIA files. I was told afterwards that I created a lot of spies in the agency. People with clearance levels that could see almost anything they wanted were suddenly going around trying to see what there was on UFOs. But so far as I know, nobody ever found anything. Now, if there was a box down there in a sealed room, my first question about this guy, Mr. Brandon, would be, do you just go down into a sealed room where there's TS material and start rummaging around saying, oh yeah, here's this, and oh yeah, here's that, and does he have any clearance for doing anything like that? Perhaps. I mean, again, just because there are rules and regulations doesn't mean that everybody obeys them to the letter. So maybe he's telling the truth. If there was a box there and he left it there, somebody else must have been able to find it. Either there's a top secret group in the CIA that's controlling this stuff and doesn't tell anybody else, and maybe by accident, Mr. Brandon found this box, and the cover-up group, when they heard that, immediately ran to get that box and put it somewhere else so if anybody did look, they wouldn't find what Mr. Brandon was talking about.
Well, Grant, that's a pretty candid statement by Bruce about the whole thing. What do you make of it?
Guessing on my part.
Yeah. My question is would, because when he describes his position, he said that he was the second most powerful person in the CIA to make public statements on behalf of the CIA outside the director of the CIA, that his office was on the seventh floor. He was with the CIA director right outside the CIA director's office. And to have this guy sort of throw, and he's actually, like, they play him as a retired guy, but he basically stated that nobody really retires, that we like to help out, and he's under contract. So he's basically still working for the CIA. I'm not really worried about the story. I'm worried about the fact that he would go on coast to coast with whatever 10, 15 million people and sort of throw the CIA under the bus, the UFO bus, without any repercussions. That's the part that sort of bothers me, that it's almost like this was planned for him to do it, because it happened on the 65th anniversary of Roswell, the same as when Corso came out. It was on the 50th anniversary of Roswell, and you get these sort of incidents happening, and I just can't believe that he, in this powerful position that he was in, would go out and do this in public, and nobody would even talk to him about it.
Well, you gotta realize that is an argument made by with respect to a lot of leaks of information. And the problem for the CIA would be, well, if we go and beat on this guy, it's going to look like we cared. It's going to look like there really was something he's covering up. So it's best to ignore it entirely. And in this situation, if they could take the box and put it somewhere else, they would cut him off at the knees, so to speak, by not leaving any positive evidence around for somebody else to find.
Yeah, that's true. Although the other thing he points out is the fact that this whole thing he claims is part of this releasing this science fiction book. And he stated that he went two or three times through the review agency. The CIA reviewed this book and told him, you've got to take this out, you got to add this. So in this little tiny science fiction book he's putting out, he goes to them and gets authorization to do all this stuff. But when he's got to go out to coast, he wouldn't think, when he knows all the rules, he was the head liaison to Hollywood, that he wouldn't know the rules to go there and sort of pre-approve this thing. And I know for a fact that before he even went on coast to coast, he was talking to some people in England, and he basically gave them the hint he was going to do this. So it's almost like it was planned. That's the part I don't understand about.
Dr. Maccabee earlier said that they like to muddle the waters, so maybe that's what's happening here.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I mean, for sure. I mean, if it did happen where he wasn't, they would stand back, because they don't want to give it any attention. But indirectly, like, for example, when it first came out, as you know, Billy Cox from Tampa Tribune contacted the archivist, the actual guy, because he comes out, he makes the statement on coast to coast. Then we write a letter to the CIA. There's four of us write the letter to the CIA. The CIA comes back to us and said, we will look into this and notify you as soon as possible. And so what would they do? They would play the tape from coast to coast. They would ask Chase Brandon, what did you say? Where's the box? And so Billy Cox goes and talks to the archivist, who would have been the guy that would have been looking for the box, and he says, I have nothing to say. I stand by the CIA statement. And their statement was not that he was lying, not that he was telling the truth, but just that there's nothing to substantiate what he said, which is, it's just a very bizarre, it's almost like this limited hangout thing where they want it out there, and they let it out, they pull it back, and then they go back to the company policy, which Chase Brannon says is, oh, the CIA has an interest in UFOs, they couldn't care less, and that's why they really wouldn't be talking to me, which doesn't make sense.
Well, we're going to get back to this subject, but I got a lot of people already in the chat room, and a couple of emails that asked something for Dr. Bruce McAbee earlier when we were talking about photographic evidence of UFOs. And Wayne, who's known as the UFO cowboy in the chat room there, had this question for McAbee. He says, if a person has an outstanding video or photo, what is the best way to get it to you, Dr. McAbee, with emails and Facebook and such being monitored so heavily these days? In other words, they're questioning whether or not you get your emails or you're on Facebook. I know you're on Facebook quite often. I have people telling me they've been censored by Facebook. I haven't. Maybe you guys have. I don't know. So, Dr. McAbee, what's the best way to get some video to you?
Well, if it can be packed into a standard video format of some sort, and it's not too long, you send it by email, brumac@compuserve.com. In my email address, and I prefer to work through that if it's at all possible. Otherwise, I suppose you can put it on a CD, put it on a DVD, and send it to me. But contact me at brumac@compuserve.com first, and I can give you an address to send a DVD to.
You know, I get a lot of leads from the public on good stories for broadcast. How about you, Grant? Do you get some interesting emails, something just over the transom in cyberspace to you that
Actually,
hands out?
That's one of the things that, like, Bruce and I were sort of involved in the 80s following Bill Moore and all the leaks there, and I always had stated that I must not be doing the right thing, because nobody's ever come and tried to leak me a classified document or anything of that nature. And I was wondering, well, you know, I must be on the wrong track, because, you know, I was always waiting for the Falcon or some bizarre person to come and say, okay, you know, I've got some stuff and here it is. It's never happened to me, ever.
Dr. McAbee, how did that Avery thing start? Did Bill Moore just manufacture that out of thin air, or how did they get started?
Well, Grant may be able to do a better history on this than I can, but my recollection is that the things began to pop when the Roswell Incident book was published in 1980, I think that was, right?
Right.
Yeah, okay, so Bill told me, and I had many conversations with him over the years, he told me that a few months or something like that after the book was published, he got a contact. And from a guy, he wouldn't say initially who it was, but I guess it turned out to be Rick Doty. Anyway, a guy in intelligence, and who told him that he was on the right track. That is, the supposed crash at Roswell was on the right track, and that there might be more information coming. And then he managed to get. He did receive some leaked documents. Perhaps the most famous of them, of the early documents, is the so-called Aquarius document, referring to Project Aquarius. It had to do with UFOs, but he got this document and some other stuff over the next several years. It wasn't until 1987, though, that the so-called Eisenhower briefing document came out public. Now, he was telling me that he had sources, okay, and two of the major sources, he wouldn't say who they were, but they were government people and intelligence, and he named them as the Condor and the Falcon. This was sort of...
And how did you get your name? Weren't you called a Seagull?
Yeah.
Who gave that to you, Bill Moore?
For too long, virtually everybody was part of the aviary. only the Condor and the Falcon, and I guess the Condor, who's this guy who's most recently come out, been named as the...
Yeah, Grant did a lot on that. We're talking about the guy nobody ever heard about, Grant. Remember his name?
Rositsky.
Right.
Yeah, the CIA guy.
Yeah, and Grant, jump in here in this conversation. This is right down your cup of tea.
Well, I think what happened, my impression of what happened was Bill put the book out, and he was contacted almost immediately, like days after he went on the book tour. And what I recall in my research was that by 1981, he said there was so much material coming in that he joined up with Jamie Chandray. And Jamie Chandray and he worked on all sorts of stuff. And I think what they did, the idea for the Avery was that when he and Jamie were talking on the phone, in order to protect who they were talking to, they would give all these people bird names. And I guess Bruce had a bird name because he was talking to you about, you know, whatever events or whatever. And he'd given a bunch of people bird names, and a lot of people didn't even know they were, you know, bird. It was an idea that Bill came up with. For example, I talked to, when Falcon was released, I contacted Scott Jones. And there was a lot of articles back in the 1990s where people were saying Scott Jones was the Falcon. So when this Rositsky guy was identified by Bill Moore's friend Greg Bishop, I went to Scott Jones and I said, well, here's the Falcon. You're no longer the Falcon. And he said that he had actually had three bird names, and he never knew which bird name was his, because that was just something between Jamie and Bill. And so nobody really knows how many birds there were or who the birds were or what their names were. Only Bill and Jamie Chandray know that secret.
How does that check out with you, Bruce?
There were lots of birds of a feather flocking, but nobody was doing this together.
You guys didn't have a bird convention someplace?
Yeah, well, there never was a bird convention. The only two birds that really counted were falcon and condor. And things got very messed up back in 87 at the UFOs, or let's see, what was the name of that show?
UFO Cover-Up Live.
UFO Cover-Up Live. It was done as a live show in October of 1987, I think it was. And at that show, they had impenetrable screen-type interviews with supposed Condor and Falcon. Actually, Condor was Robert Collins, and Falcon was Richard Doty. These were stand-ins for the real people. I understood that, but for many years, other people who were doing investigations did not understand fully that Doty and Collins were stand-ins for the real people.
Yeah.
But there was another guy who came along. It was Falcon and Condor were the only members of the aviary until about 1986. But there was another guy who came along who was given a code name Hawk. That was Ernie Kellerstrauss, a retired Air Force colonel who had been at a science branch in Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And here was a guy whose testimony would blow the lid off if he could prove it was true. I interviewed him at an extent in the end of 1985 and early 1986. And I'll have on my webpage the story that Hawk told. But as far as this aviary is concerned, as I said, it sort of grew like mushrooms in the rain. As time went on, everybody was being called... Well, anybody who worked for the government was considered to be covert, shill for the government, and given a bird name. I did something that was, I actually dug up some information that was valuable. I discovered that there were two Project Aquariuses. One of them was classified secret, the other one was classified top secret. I never did find out what the top secret one was about. Because I didn't have a TS clearance at the time. But anyway, they gave me the name Seagull, and it just sort of grew from there. Virtually anybody who was doing any UFO research related to government cover-up was given a bird name after a while. And I guess there could be a dozen or a dozen and a half birds in the aviary. There was never a group.
It wasn't formal, in other words.
It's never a formal group, and we never met. I mean, a lot of the bird people I knew because of UFO investigations, and some of them I didn't know at all. I don't know how they got names. It's been a long time since I've paid much attention to that stuff.